Welcome to another episode of the Examine Life podcast, where we take some of life's thorniest questions and deconstruct them in a way that is pragmatic and philosophical so that you can lead a more productive, examined, and joyful life. My name is Kate Yee. Today's episode, a solo episode, answering the question, what does it mean to be Asian? So I'm going to zoom us out to 2005. I was in Beijing on vacation with a handful of college buddies. We were running around town doing tourist stuff, partying. Yeah, I mean, what group of 23-year-old guys goes on a guy's trip to Beijing? But that was us. Now, we were staying at one of the fancier hotels. I believe it was Parker, the JW Marriott. And we were in the lobby. We're in the lobby. So 25-year-old K, if I'm trying to think about what I'm wearing there, I'm still in my Banana Republic era. Maybe I have a nicer designer shirt, which might be, I don't know, not like a Gucci type brand, but, you know, still in my Banana Republic days. And there's a group of Chinese young adults, probably teenagers, and they walk by me and my friends. And they start pointing and kind of giggling and saying, Neymar, Neymar, Neymar. And I just flashed them the peace symbol with a smile and went on with my day. Now, that, for example, first, if you don't know who Neymar is, he's one of the greatest soccer players there. Very, very handsome Brazilian chap. And to be a 25-year-old Asian American, we'll talk about my mix, but to be a 25-year-old Asian American guy and being called Neymar, let's just say that that was straight up goals. Plus, I mean, I fancy, back then that was probably mixed, but I fancy myself to be a decent looking human being. But back then I didn't. And Neymar is another level of male attractiveness. I mean, he's freaking Brazilian. So that was my Neymar story in China. And it actually is a consistent theme in my life. So this is an episode about Asian identity that involves passing for someone who is not Asian. So I'll give you another example, which is meeting my wife, Lisa. Now, I got to the recap of this story. And we were, when we met, it was 2007 in November at Pasha, which is those nightclubs. But not, it's in Ibiza, but not the cool one in Ibiza, which, by the way, I have been to, which is unreal. It was the corny one in New York City that's in Midtown West by the Intrepid. Anyway, I meet Lisa, and I might try to flash a picture of us. There's a picture of when we first met. And she kind of gives me eyes. I'm kind of nervous to react back. It's like, who's this pretty blonde woman? And we ended up talking and I got her number, and the rest is history. that'll be safe for another day. But she, in the hazy mood lighting that is a nightclub, with whatever crazy drinking and other stuff that we were doing that night at Pasha, she thought I was Spanish. And so later, she tells me that it was only until some later date in time, point in time, that she realized that that I wasn't Spanish. I wasn't Neymar. She didn't know who Neymar was. I was an Asian guy. And she will even joke now. She's like, I forget that you're Asian. She's like, I think I'm just married to a white guy. And so again, you'll see this theme in my life that I'm going to share how I really leaned into it, of passing for Brazilian, Greek, Spanish, Indian, Someone once asked me if I was African American, but the ability to pass as something other than Asian was something that was very, very top of mind for me. So before we jump in to the full episode, an invitation to join one of our group coaching cohorts, because one of the questions that we talk about often is identity. Identity usually through the lens of achievement, usually through the lens of status, usually through how we build up a sense of self, a sense of confidence, sometimes bordering on the line of being egomaniacal. But identity is a big piece of who we are. And in our group coaching programs, we try to take identity and separate it out from achievement, separate it out from money, separate it out from status. It's one of the many modules in that program. So check out radreads.co/coaching if you are interested. So let's rewind the clock. All right, let's step back from Pasha and Spanish K. By the way, Lisa thought that, you know, her type of guy was Gabriel Garcia Bernal from Y Tu Mama También. Some of our younger listeners might not know what heck we're talking about, but that was her type, like a dark-skinned Latino Spanish gentleman, and she got an Asian guy. So let's zoom back. First, I want to give you my official mix. You might know this by now, but as you know, I was born in New York. My parents, my dad is Cambodian, 100%, and my mom is 50% Cambodian and 50% French. So mom, if you're listening, mom would always say, you're not Asian American. I identify as Asian American. She'd say, you're Asian, right? Like, I crack myself. You're Asian, like European and Asian. But all I hear when I hear the phrase you're Asian is like, you're Asian. No, you're Asian. No, you're Asian. I don't know. That's the kid in me. But so technically I'm you're Asian, but I grew up in New York City. I'm 75% Cambodian, 25% French. And that 25% makes me look different. It makes me look different. And that is something, as you know, that I have leaned into. Many, many, many people. In fact, I was just at a dinner the other day, and one of the participants was Thai. And she asked me, are you like Thailand and Cambodia are literal neighbors geographically? And every 45 minutes during the dinner, she would turn to me or come to me or during the cocktail hour and say, I can't believe you're Cambodian. I can't believe you're Asian. And so, you know, something about my mix throws people off. So born in 1979, now you know my background. I grew up in the East Village of New York, but I was raised speaking French. And so when I got to New York, to elementary school, I took English, ESL, English as a second language. So I grew up speaking French. I am fluent in French. English is my primary language. I've never spoken Cambodian or Khmer. And that is the kind of the ethnic background, so to speak. A few other important facts. As you know, my parents immigrated to New York in 73, so 6 years before I was born. A few other relevant details. There was it was amidst the Cambodian genocide, which was after the Vietnam War. My mother's side of the family was not directly impacted because she was half French and they could move around. My father's side of the family was deeply, deeply impacted. The Cambodian genocide, I believe 1 million to 2 million people were killed, but percentage of the population was a bigger genocide percentage-wise than the Holocaust. So this is a frame. So you picture a few frames. New to New York City, no family there. Another thing about New York is there's not a lot of Cambodians in New York. There's not a lot of Cambodians in America. But as you learn more about the Cambodian community, They are kind of, most Cambodians, I believe, I'm going to butcher some of this, but are in Stockton, California, and then Long Beach, California, and then a suburb of Boston, I think called Waltham, if I'm remembering correctly, outside of Dallas, Fort Worth. And I don't know, you're going to hear this often, I don't know the history well. I don't know this because I don't. And this is kind of a internal point of contention. But I believe that many of these were where there were religious missionaries that were taking in refugees, I think. Don't quote me on that. So we're in New York as a frame, new family here, not a ton of Cambodians, and no family there. I suspect that at this point, my parents are in the process of assimilating. And so because there's not a big Cambodian community, they're just assimilating with neighbors and coworkers and school, kids, school friends, and so on. Again, not a big Cambodian community. So it's just kind of a mishmash of mostly Caucasian, white families, but it's New York. So, you know, there's a mix of all different ethnic groups, but predominantly white. A few other salient details. I went to an international school. I went to the United Nations school. The United Nations school loves to get made fun of on South Park and The Simpsons. And it's a bit of a cultural meme of sorts where, yes, kids do, diplomats send their kids there. So there is a contingent of diplomatic kids. But the reality is that the UN corporate, so to speak, is a very large employer, and you get to send your kids to the United Nations school, which is on 23rd Street on the East River, at a substantial discount. So we went to the UN school, and that provides another interesting frame because the UN school is international. And now, in hindsight, it was a wild. It's such a fucking cool school. The minority of students are white, and even the white students, they're from Ireland and like literally from Ireland, from Switzerland, from Belgium, from Ukraine. So the UN school is this like really, really like beautiful mix of people. If I think back to my best friends that went to the UN school, one was Palestinian, the other was Ukrainian, another was Norwegian, and another friend who was Belgian. So you just had this like really, really international, and I didn't appreciate it at the time. So it wasn't actually weird to go to that school being a minority because you were actually so welcoming to international populations and so on. So that's kind of the school that I go to. And so we set the stage here. This is kind of the 80s and the 90s, right? I graduated high school in 1997. But Asians are cool now, right? There's Asian men and there's Asian women, right? If you think about kind of the cultural ethnic stereotypes of the time, right? Big caveat here, of the time in the 80s and 90s, you know, it was somewhat common to see an Asian woman date a white male. It was extremely uncommon to see the reverse. And it just felt like mostly Asians dated Asians. Kind of that was at least the story I felt. And again, I'm recreating a lot of what I'm going to say in this episode is my perception of being Asian. It's my reality, right? My perception became my reality. It might not necessarily be the objective truth that was out there. And anyway, when you get into cultural and norms and perceptions, like it's hard to land on a universal truth anyway. But let's just say that in those era, that in that time period, it was not cool to be Asian. It was not even cool in the 80s to be a white nerd, right? Nerds only became cool in probably the Zuckerberg era, like kind of web 2.0 era. Like before, being a nerd, like there was a whole stereotype, like you take a nerd, you revenge of the nerds, like you rip off their glasses and you snap them into like the jock kid, and then the nerd tapes their glasses back together and like gets back to work. So in the 80s and 90s, it wasn't even cool to be a white nerd. So you can imagine what it was like to be Asian, you know, very kind of in a social setting, being an Asian male felt very low status. No one cared, right? Again, maybe my perception, maybe reality. I've spoken to many Asian men from that. It's like you just kind of didn't feel seen, right? And when you did feel seen, it was around like what were the prominent Asian voices or personalities. You're talking Bruce Lee, you're talking Jackie Chan, right? You are in, you know, it was the stereotype of Asians play the piano, Asians are good at math, Asian parents send their kids to school with the funky smelling lunches. Asians do karate, right? Asians are skinny. So it was all these kind of stories about Asians. I want to talk about Bobby Lee. Bobby Lee is a comedian who I've recently discovered kind of in the past 2 or 3 years, but he's 53. He's like 5'4", maybe, kind of short, very pudgy, always showing his belly. He's got a huge belly. And he's kind of an elder of sorts, and we'll come back to him, but he was on a show called Mad TV, which was around the time of In Living Color. And he said, like, anytime they gave him, he was the only Asian guy on the show. It was on Fox. Anytime they gave him a role, he would play like an Asian news anchor, Connie Chang, for those of you who remember. Like, he would play like Kim Jong, whoever Kim Jong Un's, like a North Korean dictator. Or he would play someone who was doing like martial arts, right? So that was kind of the representation of Asian men in the 80s and 90s, right? And yo, have you seen Barbie? You've seen Barbie, right? Fucking, I'm probably going to pronounce his name wrong. Simu Liu? Barbie, Ken, is a fucking jacked Asian dude. What the, I mean, we've come a long way. So I just bring, like, Ken is an Asian dude in Barbie, which we've come a very long way from the Jackie Chan karate days of the 80s and 90s. So I'll situate myself back into this scene. I didn't want to be Asian. Right? Full stop. I didn't want to be Asian because Asians weren't perceived as being cool. I mean, it's that simple. And even though I can only imagine if I went to a school that was predominantly Caucasian, which I know some of my friends went to fancier private schools where they're the only Asian kid or one of three. You know, at least my school probably had 20% were Asian and 20% were white. So 80% were not white in my school. So just a very unique place. And even then, I didn't want to be Asian. Big part of it was the cultural representation and what it would say or not say about you. You were weak. You were skinny. You were, people took advantage of you. You were deemed as attractive, right? These messages, I'm sure they were all internalized from culture and media, but that was the message that I took. And I'm like, fuck that. I do not want that. And that's where this kind of secret superpower or hidden power came in, that I could pass for a lot of different ethnicities. the what was it like at home with my parents? So I think that we kind of honored our Asian heritage in the way that Asians honor their heritage, which is food. And so, you know, I ate white rice every single day for 35 years. My parents still eat white rice every single day. I love white rice so much. You know, I'm borderline type 2 diabetes, so I need to be a little careful about my white rice consumption these days. But food, you know, again, there wasn't a lot of Cambodian food. We would cook. My dad would put soy sauce on hamburgers, right? He would make hamburgers and then he would eat the bun. I'm sorry, the patty with soy sauce and hot sauce and white rice. And then us American kids, like American raised kids, would be eating the actual hamburger. So food was a way. And going to Chinatown, it's kind of always eating out in Chinatown, K-Town, Japantown, and so on. So food was always a big way. History and tradition, not so much. I can, with the exception of Cambodian New Year, which I only really remember because you got money, there was not much in terms of Cambodian culture, Asian culture. Religion, I guess, I don't even know. There are some Buddhas in our house. My dad would pray to the Buddhas basically before and after any flights, airplane flights. So Buddha was there to protect you from airplane travel and mishaps. Very little talk about that. And then obviously kind of the elephant in the room, which is what the hell happened to our family during the Cambodian genocide, my dad's side of the family. Now, it's not something, it was never volunteered, right? You always had to ask questions, you being myself, ask questions about it. Even then, it always felt like this isn't something that we should talk about. At least that's the message that I got. And as I get older, I can start to really recognize the pain of what was happening. Imagine you're in a new country, you have a young family, or not even young. You know, the genocide was happening between 75 and 79. And so I was born in 79. So you're in your late 20s. You move to a country where you have you don't know anyone. And then this is a time when long distance phone calls were, you know, $5 a minute. And you're getting letters. I can't even imagine. I haven't even asked my dad about that. But now as a dad, you know, I'm thinking about holding my baby daughter when they were babies and thinking about like being stressed about something. Like my course sales went down and totally like tuning out when that happened. Imagine it's like your family's dead. Like I cannot imagine what that must be like to be. Now that I'm a parent, right? And that phase, I'm in a similar phase of life that my dad was when this was happening, a little bit older, actually. So that's the story. I mean, I did use my Cambodian heritage to write a banger of a college admissions essay. I do remember collaborating with my dad on that. I don't remember much what it was about. I do remember him shedding a few tears when I was interviewing him about some of the backstory there. So not much talk about Cambodian heritage, but like, what was the Asianness? So what were the Asian values? Like, my parents have tiger proclivities. So there was definitely tiger style parenting. There was a very, very strong focus on academics, not a focus on, what do they call it now? social emotional learning. My daughter has social emotional learning courses. There was none of that. Very achievement oriented. But you know, tightness of family, respect elders, you know, being a little bit more passive, conflict avoidant. Those were some of the things that I really remember kind of about being Asian besides the white rice. Things like taking your shoes off, feet on, you know, on pillows, like feet where you would put your head, things like that. So around, I would say that the Asianness comes in on respect for elders, academics, and the importance of family, even though we didn't have a lot of family that was nearby. So then you have this K who's shy and insecure. By the way, I was a skinny ass motherfucker as a kid. I was skinny. I walked awkwardly. My hair was all fucking janked up. You know, I didn't know what my sense of style was. You know, I had a lot of that, like that was the early days of streetwear and hip hop culture. So you had this skinny ass Cambodian dude that was wearing, you know, Carl Kanai jeans and polo, a lot of different polo shirts and sweatshirts. Remember the Polo Bear, that kind of stuff. By the way, a lot of that stuff was secondhand. So we either, like, I shared this in another episode, we would like go to some stores and swap the price tags to get things cheaper, or I would do people's homework and they would give me their like second, like the, like if it would give the one older version of the clothing. So I would do someone's homework, this guy, Jeff, an Indian guy, and then he would give me his Carl Kanai jeans from the previous season. And I would do his homework for him. So that was kind of the conflicting views. And by the way, like there were no women. Like there was no women were interested in me. I was fully friend zone all day, every day. I had very low self-confidence. And, you know, again, through this message of culture and who are the high status people, like I think about the TV shows, right? It was Full House and Charles in Charge, Beverly Hills 90210, The Heights. Y'all remember The Heights? Beverly Hills 90210. I'm like, yo. And then the one after, Party of Five, right? Jared Leto, Luke Perry. And who are the attractive women? Tiffany Amber Thiessen, Jenny Garth. Jennifer Love Hewitt from Party of Five. That's the message culture was telling young Asian. Who gets the girl? It's fucking Luke Perry, right? Or it's Brandon, whatever Brandon's name is. Rest in peace, Luke Perry. That was the message. It wasn't Simu Liu fucking, you know, Asian Ken. And so for me, and I would suspect for many Asian men, there was a status element of, or a status, or just it's not possible. I didn't think it was possible. I didn't think it was possible for me to date anyone when I was in middle school and high school. But I thought it was fucking impossible that I would ever date a white woman. Now, I am attracted to white women. I married a white, blonde, beautiful woman. I have never dated an Asian woman. I've never dated a mixed Asian woman. I think I've hooked up with maybe a handful of Asian women. And so I've never been attracted to Asian women predominantly. But is that because I was seeking the forbidden fruit, the forbidden fruit of a blonde, like a blonde haired, green eyed woman? Or was I rebelling? Or was I daydreaming? That is a question that I'm not sure of the answer of. I can only see how it played out. So I didn't date white women. So you add to the fact that I was fucking skinny as hell. And that was 138 pounds when I graduated college. I was a gymnast. I played Magic. I mean, I had all the cards were stacked against me. And so I had this kind of fantasy, like one day, maybe I'll be able to date a white woman. And to be honest, like all of the things that I'm telling, dating being one of the drivers, is what made me so focused on work and money. Because I was like, if they're not going to like me for my external appearance, the way I look, my skin color, the fact that I'm Asian, well, if I have money and if I have status, then I have a greater chance of getting, well, I think at the end of the day, it was love and status, right? It was, even today, like Lisa and I, when we see an Asian man dating or walking with a white woman, I'll point to her. I was like, remember, when was the last time we saw that? And usually it's like 9 months ago, last year, right? It's still quite rare, much more common, but still quite rare. So there was a status piece about that. But that's where the passing of being seen as Brazilian, Hawaiian, Greek was like, yes, I can downplay that. I can play down my Asianness. I can lean into my ethnic ambiguity and try to, you know, like I don't look traditional Eastern Asian. I don't look Chinese. I don't look Japanese. I don't look Korean. So I can kind of do an end around. And I think that actually caused problems with my like Korean friends. They'd be like, dude, you're not Asian. What do you mean? I'm from fucking Cambodia. Like, you're not Asian. And I think it was that tension that was like, you can pass for something else and we can't. And not only that, I really leaned into it. And many of those Asian friends ended up marrying Asian women and really struggled their entire lives to date Asian women. And they resented that like in like when we were in the dating phases of our lives. And I was like, phew, I dodged a bullet. Okay, so let's get to college now. College is where everything changes. Again, I get to college, I weigh 138 pounds. I'm the biggest freaking nerd in my school, quasi-valedictorian, go to Yale. It's a fresh restart. I'm like, all right, I'm amongst my fellow nerds here. No one knows my backstory. No one knows I'm Asian. Let's fucking go, right? And so immediately, college is like where my high agency part of life really goes gangbusters. And a few things happen. One is I discover creatine and lifting. And so I basically single-handedly changed my body constitution. I went from 138 pounds, having never lifted weights. I was a gymnast. To at my peak 180, being able to bench, I didn't probably back then, like 275 pounds, right? And I would wear these like cut off shirtless sleeves. People would always joke. They're like, "Oh, well, you forgot your sleeves." So I had huge arms, especially for an Asian guy, and I really leaned into that. There's a funny story once where I didn't like my cat. I have chicken legs, and so I'm like, I'm gonna get rid of my chicken legs. And I decided that I would do 1,000 calf raises every day. And I basically taped together this little contraption, a piece of plywood with these little plywood, little stilts of sort. And I just carry this thing around and do calf raises to the point that I couldn't walk for days on end. But again, it was this belief that like, okay, now I can pass as not being Asian. Now I can physically change the way that I look. And guess what? Now I am getting attention from women, and specifically white women. And that was a very, I mean, college for me was a very transformative point in my life because it did give me that reset. But at the same time, it also gave me that. It's, I mean, I look back, if like, if I hadn't changed the shape of my body, then a lot of my life would have played out differently. I mean, it sounds so superficial and sad when you state it that way. But I mean, I think the reality is, like, I don't know, like, I don't think if I was 138 pound kind of skinny Asian guy, I don't think Lisa would have made eyes with me at the nightclub, right? So college was one of these moments. Fun fact, Yale has this like 50 most beautiful issue, and your boy made it in to that issue. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, I'm getting recognized for the way that I look after being so insecure for 18 years. And so the cool thing about Yale, by the way, is that, and this is something that has happened more and more, is that we have a phenomenal group of friends, many of whom are listening to this. So I love you guys. The friend group that we assembled at Yale was mostly not white. There were like Indian, Mexican, Lebanese, Nigerian. And I think Yale was pretty, I think it's different in that regards, that the minorities tend to like really stick together, but it wasn't like the black fraternity or the Asian, you know, the Asian group. It was like a very, like, the friend groups were very, very diverse. There were definitely like the Andover, Exeter kind of crowd, but there was also this whole other group. And it was amazing. And those are some of my closest friends to this day. And so there is something about, and I do think back, you know, that I think it's less about, I find a lot of bond with people who grew up with limited means. Like, and again, I've said many times, we did not grow up in poverty. We were lower middle. But when you, there's this kind of shared struggle that a lot of lower middle, who oftentimes are kids of immigrants, but not always. And there's just a deep, deep sense of connection of being able to see one another with that group of people. And so that's something that I've noticed. Another thing I've noticed too, I don't know if I give out like brown guy energy vibes, but a friend, we were saying how like when we go to places and there's someone, a person of color, and usually not African American, so like Mexican, Asian, and mixed race, they're always like, they like pour us stiffer drinks. We were at Salt and Straw, like an amazing ice cream place, and me and my friend who's Mexican, and we ordered a kid's scoop ice cream, and it was a Mexican person serving the ice cream, and he just gave us a smile, and he gave us like a triple. And so I think there is this something about like, I see you, we have this shared experience, and I think it's I love this part of not being white, is that there is this kind of kinship, unspoken kinship, with a lot of other minorities. So then we got into my career, and I think one thing that in my career that has always been interesting is that I talked about this in the networking episode, is I can shapeshift identities. So I can, with my Asian friends, you know, like Asians have like a sense of humor, a way of kind of making fun of each other, the way we might talk like with like hip hop lingo, I can play, and it's not manipulative. Like I can just like drop in and like I can like play, be Asian. You could put me in the room with like the whitest Andover, Harvard, McKinsey consultants, and I can, you know, I can speak and kind of hang in that group and feel very comfortable. You could put me in a room with like frat boys that want to pound beers. Not so much anymore, but I could play in that room. You know, you could put me in a room with like the weirdo creatives and I can be in that room. I think that was always a skill of mine. I think in hindsight, there's probably some kind of shape-shifting identity that probably in the long term isn't a great thing, but it definitely served its purpose there. And so I think that that was, and I think this is all facilitated by the fact that people don't actually know what ethnic category to put me in. Right. I think maybe this would be harder if I looked more traditionally Asian, maybe. I don't know. So there's the issue of the bamboo ceiling, which is, you know, a lot of Asians will hit that kind of mid-level, like middle management ceiling, but cracking into the more executive tier is actually pretty uncommon for Asian men. It's called the bamboo ceiling. Now, I didn't crack that level because I left, but I feel very confident that I could have cracked that level. And I do think that it's because of this ability to like, I can be fratty when I need to be fratty. And this actually brings me to a question. I hadn't thought about this before, where people ask me, a lot of Asian American men have come to younger men and said, like, I can't do that. And I really think that it is stifling my ability to get promoted. And I didn't feel that. So I'm trying to like tap into the empathy of what that means. I think I hear a few different things. I think that the being able to, you know, play white in different rooms it's definitely a skill or something that's not easy to do, right? It does require kind of like baseline. I mean, there's a way to think about it. Like, look, a lot of it revolves, we always joke, like people, like a lot of white conversations, especially in my town, are around college football. Couldn't give a fucking rat's ass about college football. But I still read ESPN every day. I could still have enough of a way. I can have a semi-educated conversation about college football, even though I don't give a shit about it. So would I recommend someone do that? There is a part of it that feels really, really inauthentic, right? But I'll say that there's probably other parts of quote unquote being Asian that can be, you know, addressed more head on. So for example, in general, again, I recognize this stereotype, but avoiding conflict, right? I believe that, you know, if you want, we're talking now specific about moving up the food chain, the chain of command in corporate America. I believe that if you want to do that, you have to put yourselves in a situation with conflict. And look, how do you get better at conflict? I mean, that's an entire podcast episode. It touches on confidence. It touches on catastrophizing. It touches on, you know, the role of emotions, how you push back. It touches on narrative building. It touches on coalition building, right? So I do think that there's a lot of ways. If you say like, I'm conflict avoidant, well, you still need to understand how political alliances are formed. Now, whether you choose to engage with them or not, that's a completely different story. But recognize that political alliances are formed in corporate America. And if you're not one who understands how to do them, or if you're choosing to opt out of political alliances, it's going to hurt you. Like, you will hit the bamboo ceiling. Right. So I think that you can, you know, so that's one. Another would be just like around confidence, like public speaking. Right. I think I would suspect, again, stereotype here, one that I've seen amongst my peer group is that Asians feel less confident doing public speaking. And again, you could probably trace that back to how we were raised, how our parents were raised, and so on, being foreigners in this country, being outside of the, you know, cultural mainstream norms. So that would be another example. So that's alliance building, conflict, confidence, conflict, facing conflict. What are other ways that Asian Americans hit the, I mean, there's probably a very like a simple one is advocating for yourself. And it's, I'll stop there. But advocating for yourself is something that is not just handed to you. And again, if you didn't see your parents advocating for themselves because they were just happy to be in this fucking country, then you're probably less likely to advocate for yourself. All right. Let's jump fast forward to today. So I never thought Asian men are having a moment, whether it's in comedy. I was watching, have you seen the show Physical 100? It's a Korean reality show where they take the 100 best physiques, men and women, in South Korea. Bro, they're some of the hottest bodies on men and women you have ever seen. Like there's one dude that looks like three dudes that look like Mr. Olympia. Like their traps are bigger than my bicep. There are MMA fighters that look like they could kill anyone. It is unreal. And it's like the number three show on Netflix right now. So Asian American men are having their moment. Comedians, Bobby Lee, actors, Simu Liu, I apologize for pronouncing his name incorrectly. I should have researched him before. Who's a Marvel superhero? He's Ken. In sports, you have more. You have UFC fighters. You have golfers. There's representation everywhere. And let me tell you this. I am of the Gen X mindset that like representation, who cares? You just lift yourself up by the bootstraps and you do you, right? Don't worry about it. Like, can I tell you, seeing these Asian men who are talented and gifted in all these unique ways, like really, really moves me. And it really made me, I think I was a bit brutish on the representation question. I'm like, yeah, I had more of a like deal with it. Like, look, that's how Hollywood works. And you're just not going to get shirtless Asian men in your movies. Deal with it. And then when I saw him, like, God, it's so good. Like, it feels so familiar. It feels like, yeah, it's this sense of belonging. I'll tell you, for our blog post, I use AI to generate the images. All of the images that I generate for our blog posts are all people of color. Not because I'm trying to create some statement, just because I'm like, those are my people. Right? So the representation thing is really, really beautiful. The question has come up about kids. So Lisa, she joked today. She's like, I forget you're Asian all the time. Right? So think about this. You have a blonde Caucasian, middle-class suburban spouse and a guy who I forget that I'm Asian sometimes. And we live in a very white neighborhood and you can start to see away from our families and you can start to see this like fraying of our Asian heritage, right? Because not that mom doesn't care. Mom's like, I'm just as interested as you learning that we're part Danish and part Irish, right? Just as important as your Cambodian heritage and your French heritage, right? I think it's something that we're losing a bit because it's not kind of central. I think that a lot of the things that I value from my Asian values, I think Lisa and I both value them to different extents. So we try to keep that in. We talk a lot of food. Asian food is a big, big part of our lives. And yeah, I think the exposure, I would say travel, but we haven't traveled to that many Asian countries. I mean, right now my daughter's into Hello Kitty and so there is the whole kind of Sanrio influence in our house, but I don't think that's what y'all mean when you say like how your kids reacting to it. I will say though that there's one wild card new development that has really changed things for me. Like really changed things. Because again, I never strongly in my blood felt that Asianness and definitely not the Cambodian heritage. Last year, there were two articles written about me. There was a CNBC article written about me, and there was a Business Insider article. And those two are kind of like mass media publications. And they just got crazy reach. And something unexpected happened when those articles. I mean, obviously traffic went up and newsletter subscribers went up and all that stuff. But it was the first time that Cambodians who were younger than me, who were born in America, saw these articles and they reached out to me. I'd say at least 10, probably close to 15. And there's a term of endearment, of respect, Uncle Bong in Cambodian, and they would say like Uncle K. It's just great to see Cambodia, like the representation. It's great to see what it looks like to be a successful professional Cambodian in America. And it was really, it has been one of the most moving things about my life that I haven't talked much about in the past year, because it made me realize that there was this real emptiness as it related to that part of my soul, that part of my heritage. And I bet many of y'all are listening. So I thank you for reaching out. I thank you for inviting me into your stories. And what I'll say about Cambodian Americans is a few things. One is Cambodians are incredible people. They are so loving. They're so warm. They love to have a good time. And another thing about Cambodians is because of the Khmer Rouge and the civil war and the genocide, there's so much trauma in community, intergenerational trauma. And these are words that I don't use lightly and I wouldn't have even used as of a year ago. But there is so much pain in that community. And you have these American educated, American born kids, or they're now adults, that are just in the way that I'm doing this to trying to figure myself out, they're doing it as well. And it was just such an incredible, it has been such like literally a highlight of the past couple of years is to meet this group of fellow Cambodians. We started a WhatsApp group together. We do a monthly call where each person shares their history. And these histories, they involve refugee camps, they involve poverty, they involve like a much bigger struggle than I personally had. And there's just so much love and learning and support. You know, I'd say too that for me, there's actually a lot of shame there, because now I'm like, oh, the whole passing thing, like I did that when it was convenient for me, when it was helpful for me to not be Asian, not be Cambodian, to get something that I wanted. And like I said, it kind of came at this quiet cost where you find these people, this community, and I feel a ton of shame. I feel a ton of shame that I acted. I feel a ton of shame that I don't know the language. I feel like a ton of shame that, you know, I've had this success relative to, as a cohort, I believe Cambodian Americans are some of the poorest amongst Asians. So Cambodian Americans kind of break the model minority myth in the wrong direction. So there's shame that I didn't, that I was not, I wasn't impacted by that. And I have always felt like a strong calling for service, community service. I've done a plethora of different volunteer activities. Most recently, homeless mentoring in LA, mentoring individuals who came out of homelessness. I did a lot of STEM stuff with kids. And I've always felt this strong need to give back because of so much that I had. But I will say that as I got older and busier and had kids and had less attention, less time to volunteer, I did feel that I needed my service to be more aligned, right? And it's not that I'm misaligned with homelessness in LA, but it's not the thing that moves my soul. And I'll be honest about that. It's not. I care and I want it to be resolved, but it's not the thing that moves my soul. And being connected with these fellow Cambodian Americans and recognizing just the struggles as a community with our elders, our parents, with our descendants around identity and the struggles of being, of assimilating or integrating or being thriving in a difficult world that America can be if you're not, if you don't start in the right starting block, it's just been an opening for me, one that I'm deeply moved by. I don't know where it's going to take me. This group of people is amazing. They've been so supportive to my growth. I'm trying to help as much as I can. And so maybe I'll leave you with that, you know, you can feel called to service and impact. And there's impact that, you know, the world needs. And that's great. And we should continue to serve what the impact, the needs of the world with our service and our volunteer work and our dollars. And then there's something that moves you beyond, that becomes personal, that becomes a part of you, your past, your future, your offspring. And to feel called and pulled into that is a beautiful thing. So thank you. I love you all. Hope you enjoyed this.